You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Rule number one, don't open the door.
Wow, how did they film that? What is going on?
I think that was one of the best scenes I've seen in a lot of movies.
When you're watching them, you're like, what am I watching?
I don't even want to talk about it.
Oh, no, you love me. You know you love me.
This is like art, dude. This is like right in your face, incredible.
I can't stop watching it. What the hell is going on?
What the hell is going on?
I mean, I fell in love with it from the opening credits.
It just kind of blew my mind how brilliant it was.
We just know. We can tell. We've watched so many VHS movies.
Yeah, we are sad, sad people. Hello, hello, hello out there in YouTube land and podcast land. Woo. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about key influences of horror movies and science fiction films and those little elements that make them either slightly above or definitely different from the rest. For those of you joining us today for the first time, how do I begin? David and I are old friends that have been talking about movies for much longer than we would like to admit. And now we get together weekly and we share our knowledge and our experience with you.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you returning, you already know this. How do you know what movies we're going to discuss? There are three ways, and I'm going to tell you what they are. You can join our Facebook page, Johnny Has the Keys, and we do promos every Thursday prior to the Monday of the show.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can sign up for our email list, which is on our website, johnnyhasthekeys.com, and we send that email out Friday before the Monday that we do our show.
Mm-hmm.
And three, you can become a patron on our Patreon page, and we will send you the whole list in advance, the entire season. Just wanted to let you know those things, because sometimes people are like, how do we know what you're going to do? And that's how you'll know.
That's awesome.
I am here with my good friend David today. David, how are you doing?
That's awesome. That's great. You could plan your whole listening year and looking in advance. That's great. Yes.
Or at least get to see the movie in advance before we talk about it.
Right. Yeah. So it might be one of those. And plus the fact that we do have, if you subscribe or we give you notifications and all of that. And also, if you go to the website, you can look back at the past 6 years of all the films that we have covered. And one of the reasons I say that as a segue is because the first
2 years and just a bit of the third.
We did not have our YouTube channel up. We were only a straight podcast. And that's why if you go on our YouTube channel, if you're on there now and you look at seasons one and two, you'll just see a static image and then hear our lovely, very badly mixed voices do the podcast. And now we have a podcast on YouTube, and so we've decided that we would redo or start the redux of those first two seasons.
Yeah, a few of the classic episodes, I would say.
Yeah.
Not all of them, but the strong ones, for sure.
Yeah, and yes, and we are like uber super strong today. I'm so excited. This is my world, so this is a good one. I mean, I know you like this film as well, so it's also a good one for us to jump into and dive into and play today.
It's our redux number three for this season. We've already done The Exorcist and The Thing.
Yep.
And today, I'll let David tell you what we're about to dive into.
Well, I will say in preface that not only is this one of my favorite science fiction movies of all time, this is probably one of my favorite movies of all time and was an extremely influential movie in my life, so to speak, and others, as we'll talk through as we go through it. I mean, I have like pages and pages and pages of trivia. We probably won't get to all of it, but we can play with it too. This is 1956. We're going all the way back to 1956 to a classic called Forbidden Planet. those of you who are unfamiliar with this, we do spoilers, so please go watch the movie right now and come back, because we're going to talk about every little nitpicking detail of this genius piece of work. Tim, when was the first time you ever saw Forbidden Planet?
The first time I ever saw it was the first time we covered it on this podcast.
Oh, my God. I've forgotten that. Could not believe that. Really?
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons you were pushing it so much, because you were very upset that I had not seen it.
That's right. That's right. It's like a couple of those that you've given me horror-wise where you've said, you haven't seen that? Really? I can't believe you've never seen that movie. You know, sort of thing. This is one of the... I do remember... Why am I right in recollecting you did like it? Right when you watched?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I actually watched it twice for this one, so I've seen it three times now.
Excellent. I've probably seen it probably a dozen times at least, and caught bits of it throughout the years, because the first time I ever saw it was on television. Of course, I didn't see the release in 56.
We weren't alive,
and or any other re-releases since then. But I did finally see it on the big screen. And it is in CinemaScope. I mean, it's awesome and well done and bigger than life. And this movie is hugely influential to science fiction filmmaking. To me, Forbidden Planet ranks up there with Star Wars. It ranks up there with Blade Runner. It, as far as the influence that it had on science fiction, probably more so than those two, I think. Maybe not more so than Star Wars, but definitely had a huge influence for decades on science fiction.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that, because the next redux we do is in the horror genre, and it's probably one of the most influential horror movies I can think of as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're all about influence here.
And that's it. What
I think
we do.
I said that recently.
Key influences. It's interesting, this a little bit of trivia about this. It's directed by Fred Wilcox. Fred Wilcox's big claim to fame was Lassie Come Home.
I was going to say, is Timmy in the Well? Because right. I can't believe that's the only other thing he's really known for.
Agreed. And mostly family fare, westerns. This is his only science fiction film in his entire legacy, which is very interesting. It was written by Cyril Hume, who was known for westerns. He actually did, though,
and television.
Come yeah. from television theater, like Playhouse 90 and all of those. So he was good at the character bits and the dialogue and all that kind of almost Howard Hawksian kind of dialogue stuff. It was also written...
I have an interesting bit of trivia on Cyril Hume.
Yeah.
That it kind of plays into something that we always have these weird recurring motifs that sometimes pop up in our seasons. And this season, it has been George Sanders, the actor that was in Village of the Damned. He was also, I mean, he's been in a lot of stuff. And he is Cyril Hume's brother-in-law.
Oh, I did not know that. That's a good connection. No. That's very good.
Anyway, I discovered him also in a movie called Lured. Earlier. I mean, it's not that I discovered him. It's just that for some reason, George Sanders keeps popping up this season, even though we really don't have any movies, I don't think, with him.
We're not doing Jungle Book at all.
Yeah, he's in Jungle Book too.
Yeah, he's Shere Khan.
That's great.
But yeah. So, Cyril Hume, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Irving Bloch, who came from special effects, he was actually a matte painter and came up with the idea. And Alan Adler also came from theater. He is also attributed to the screenplay for this. It was originally conceived by Adler in 1952, and it was really his brainchild, but he couldn't write it himself. And actually, his credit was not on the original title. It was added later. And do you know why?
Because he did a script doctor deal or something? I don't know.
He was part of the McCarthy blacklist. He was blacklisted.
Wow. And I just watched a miniseries about that.
And so, yeah. So later on, in all the new prints and everything you see Alan Adler as part of the writing team. But in the original, he couldn't even be credited because he was blacklisted. Yeah.
Communist. Probably not. He was accused of it.
Yeah, probably not.
There is another writer you may be leaving out, some Elizabethan playwright, I believe.
Oh, well, that's kind of a key, but yeah. It's interesting because, and I was kind of going toward that, when Adler first came out with it, it was called Fatal Planet, and it was set on Venus. And it was actually Cyril who came
up. Not very far.
It was actually Cyril Hume who came up with the idea of, well, what if we patterned it after Shakespeare's The Tempest? And that strengthens the character and makes him less villainous and like a mad scientist. And we can make him a little bit more scientific, magic, complex, blah, blah, blah. And that's when they added Altera and everything else. So it's interesting to see how this script developed and was based on, what, 15th century Elizabethan prose, you know?
Shakespeare in space.
And it works. It works really well in this story. For those, I guess...
And it's only loosely connected, really, but you could see a little bit of influence in there.
Yes. For those of you who haven't watched it or need a reminder and you don't want to rewatch it before you listen to us, a simple, quick sort of synopsis is we follow an intergalactic spaceship from Earth called the C-57. It's commanded by Commander Adams, and he has a crew of roughly 15 or 20, including, of course, an XO, a doctor, a cook who's kind of comic relief, whatever. They have been sent to search for any survivors of a previous ship called the Bellerophon, which had a bunch of scientists that were sent out to the edge of the galaxy. They enter into orbit around Altair 4, and they're talked to by a radio of a voice on the radio saying, "Don't land here. We don't need your help. We're all fine." And instead, he said his orders are go down, land, and check on everything. So they do. They are greeted by a mechanical robot named Robbie, and he takes them to this palatial little place with a lake and a nice house and everything else where they meet Dr. Morbius. Morbius is one of the survivors of the Bellerophon, the only real survivor of the Bellerophon. He and his daughter, Altera. His wife was killed. The captain was killed. Everybody else in the crew was killed.
Actually, his wife died of natural causes later.
Yes. But everybody else...
The rest of the people were killed.
Correct. Yeah. Everybody else was killed. When questioned, he says it was just a force from the planet, an alien force that killed them all.
Yeah, he kind of blows it off like it's no big thing.
Yeah, yeah. And there's...
He dies, but no big deal.
But no big deal. And we don't need any help. Bye-bye. Go away.
Yeah, don't land here.
He kind of has a back and forth with Commander Adams, but finally they kind of come to an agreement, and he decides to show him what he has discovered on Altair 4, which is the remnants of an ancient civilization, this huge, extremely advanced race, tunnels that go down for miles into the planet, all sorts of technology that is just unfathomable by the minuscule human brain, and all of this. As the story develops, suddenly the commander's crewmen start being attacked. The ship starts being attacked by this unseen force. And then it goes into the last act, which is kind of really cool and neat and resolved. What about scenes? Do you have scenes you remember from this? Because basically, I love every scene in this movie, but do you have scenes that come to mind?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, my favorite scene would be when you first see the actual monster of the head animated. It's very Disney-esque. Because Disney did do the special effects for this film. And so that, especially the guy that, I think he's like third in command, Jerry.
Yeah.
When he goes and Adam says, "No, Jerry, don't." And he gets picked up by the monster and he's like shaken and glowing and then, you know, thrown down or whatever. Mm-hmm. That scene right there would be, of course, a monster scene. That's the first thing I'm going to go to. And the second would be the scene you'd probably go to first when she's skinny dipping in the, what looks like a little oasis in, I guess, their backyard, and the tiger attacks and he vaporizes it.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that's a really cool effect. And then maybe third would be when they go down into the Krell workings, which is powered by 9,200 thermonuclear reactors.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this enormous space that I guess these giant aliens left behind.
The Krell.
Well, you know, yeah, they went extinct, so to speak. So those would be the three scenes, I think, that come to mind immediately.
I agree with all of those. I also love the first attack when you're just seeing the footprints of the creature as they go up the steps and, you know, enter the ship and all of that. a slight correction. Disney did all of the animations for this, but they didn't do the special effects. The special effects were all Universal. Universal had decided that they were going to take their normal Universal musical treatment, but treat this science fiction story that way. So that was one of the key things that Fred Wilcox brought to the show, to the production, which I thought was interesting. And by the way, there's all kinds of behind the scenes and making ofs and retrospectives and yada yada that you can find on Forbidden Planet. I mean, it's from 1956. It's a classic. Everyone loves it, that sort of thing. Even down to like the scene, they now have outtakes or unedited, I guess, reprint. No, reprints is bad. They've got footage that they never used or footage prior to animations of like Jerry being picked up and you can see the wires and everything else and him floating and all that. Funny. And then he's dropped over here on the pad and you can see that actually, it's really cool. Early stuff with Robbie and like, he doesn't have his legs. The guy's like actually walking with human legs and he's just the upper torso of Robbie. So
it's like raw footage.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Very well said. I should have thought of that term. I couldn't think of it. But so you can find all that on there. But one of the things is an interview with Anne Francis, and she actually says, you know, what Fred brought to it was, we need to treat all of this realistically. This is all really happening, blah, blah, blah. So don't treat it like other people have treated science fiction in the past, you know, decades or so, of kind of comical or old fantastical sort of thing. Instead, this is very real. And of course, casting people like Walter Pidgeon kind of helped with that sort of thing. So this was, you know, MGM and Universal bringing the, you know, MGM specifically bringing the big budget musical to life in a sci-fi way sort of thing. What do I have for some of my notes in here?
You were on scenes. Did you want to say any other scenes besides the footstep scene?
I love yours. Of course, I love the monster scene. I love the footstep scene. Mm-hmm. I do like vaporizing the tiger. I do like the Krell workshop or the Krell. But I also love almost every ship, all the prologue, all the bookends. I love all the stuff on the ship. I love the way Adams is the commander of it. I like the whole decompression or coming out of hyperspace sort of sequence, the way they have built this whole set. Trivia about that, the scenic designer had all these ideas and all the stuff they wanted to do. And MGM kind of basically just let them go in the beginning of pre-production. So he started building all these sets, like building Morbius's house and building the spaceship and all of that, but only got like a third of them done and used up all the budget. And then Jim came back and said, what? And he goes, I'm going to need more money to finish these. That's just, and so he kind of pushed them into a corner to up the budget to get these sets realized. Wow. Yeah. These whole two-story sets for the spaceship and everything. Yeah.
I think the sets and everything are very impressive.
They
remind me. There's a million things that remind me of Star Trek, and that is one of them.
Oh, yeah.
The sets like look like Star Trek sets, especially when she is swimming in that pool that's obviously a soundstage.
Yeah, and trivia or a key about that. Do you know what soundstage that is?
Desilu?
That's Munchkin Land from Wizard of Oz.
I did know that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a redress of the same soundstage
because it's on the MGM lot. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, and a correction from earlier. I said that it was originally Fatal Planet, and it was set on Venus. It's set on Mercury. It was set on Mercury. So that I just found that in my notes.
What about your comment on the effects not being just Disney but Universal?
I'm sorry.
Is this an MGM film?
And that was correction too. MGM, not Universal.
Oh, okay. So, yeah. All right, it was the effect. Everything's MGM with a little bit of Disney.
Yeah. Yeah. basically, that's again because the way this whole thing was produced and realized, no one had done this large scale of science fiction film before. And so they kind of didn't know how to do it. So they kind of let stuff happen. And it was genius that, you know, they had Wilcox and they had Hume and the way it worked out in this cast. But so they ended up saying, we don't even know what a laser blaster would look like. And so they had to borrow animators from Disney to come in and help them kind of conceive that and do the anime. That's why sometimes you see them and the gun is like pointed like this, but they're supposed to be shooting, you know, downrange at the monster, and they're like pointed like this, and it's going dat, 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 dat. You know, it's like, because we didn't know what that was gonna effect was gonna look like.
Right.
That's the footage we were given.
I assumed it was because the monster was so tall.
Yeah. That's the footage we were given. We had to animate it the way it was. And you mentioned Star Trek. I mean, once we get into keys, I've got an entire list of Star Trek keys from this.
Right. I mean, this is if this movie didn't exist, I doubt Star Trek would.
I totally agree. Not only just in the look, the appearance, other things, little details, props, all of that, but the whole mythology of it, you know, the whole thematic of man is unfit to have limitless power. Okay, that's Gene Roddenberry. You know, that's his big, that and The Search for God, that's Gene Roddenberry's two biggest plots that he just retreaded over and over. But like I said,
they do a few things that are kind of funny that don't sound realistic, like when they go 100 million miles in 24 hours.
Yes. Yeah.
Or the plastic educator. Every time he says that, I get cracked up. I'm like, what is a plastic educator?
Oh, yeah. The big thing with the... I do like the fact, though, that's a very science fiction-y kind of throwaway that they don't even mention, but the fact that this thing would never fit a human. It is so huge. These things, and you never, ever see the creatures. You never, ever see the Krell. We don't know what they looked like. There's not even a picture of them anywhere. We know that their doors are this funky kind of diamondy shape, so they must be more broad than they are tall, kind of thing. But so yeah, it had a lot of firsts in this one. I've got a list of firsts. You know, you can't mention it was one of the first major, huge, big science fiction films. It was the first film to have a soundtrack created without any form of musical instruments. So no musical instruments were used. Instead, it was the first electronic score. And it was done by Louis and B.B. Baron. They did it all electronically. They were first just going to do the sound effects using electronic equipment. But Wilcox and the studio liked what they were doing so well, they let them score the entire movie. And I'm sure as this podcast progressed, you might hear some of the score in places, kind of thing. But they were part of the music union. And since they used no instruments, they could not be, the union would not let them be credited as being composers, because they never composed anything for an instrument. It was all electronic. So they were only listed as creating electronic tonalities in the credits. And that
it's very unique, and I appreciate it mostly. There's a few times when they do it, and it's a little out of place and jarring. Like when he's talking to Altera, and they're getting romantic or whatever, and all of a sudden you hear like something that sounds like a... It's not a theremin, but it sounds
sort
like
of. One. Yes, I'm agreed.
Like, I'm like, why are they playing that now in this scene?
Right.
Most scenes I do like it.
And that also prevented them from being nominated. They could not be nominated for an Academy Award because they couldn't be credited for it. So that was sad.
Wow.
First, really quick. So, first movie with humans in a ship of their own creation. So, and that, I found that. I was looking at it online. I was going, really? That was before? Like, but yeah, in a spaceship outside the not just going from the Earth to the moon. So an interstellar spaceship of their own creation, not an alien. First movie set on a foreign planet entirely. The entire movie is set either on the ship or on the planet. We don't go to Earth. We don't go to an Earth station, any of that. First movie that went beyond the solar system. First movie to show faster than light travel. First robot with a personality. We've had robots, and I'm sure when we talk about keys, we'll mention previous and past robots sort of thing. But this was the first one with a real personality. First science fiction film with any form of budget at all. MGM just kept tripling the budget for this. As you know, I would mention the first miniskirt ever shown. This Anne Francis's costuming was before miniskirts became popular. This was in the 50s, so miniskirts weren't in at all.
No, they came in the 60s, I think.
Yeah. First time animation was done without cells. So this animation was actually done in a photographic process to show the blasters and the creature itself and everything else. And it was not done with painted cells like Disney was used to. As a matter of fact, the animator kind of just did ink sketches of the creature. And that's what they actually used to create the animations. They kind of photographed them. And then did them in reverse so that they lit up instead of being dark dots on the paper. And that light up, you know, that colored red kind of look is what they used to have them to create the creature. So first time without cell. First time a gentleman named Leslie Nielsen was ever on film.
Was this his first movie?
Yep. This was his first movie. And he's great.
I mean, I knew. Yeah. I knew he did Tammy and The Bachelor. But I didn't know which came first.
Other notes. Like I said, the art department only built half the sets, forcing the budget to be increased by the studio. The director approached this as a really serious project and demanded that all of his actors treat it that. Even the comic Cookie character, they still treated as like he was aboard a submarine, so to speak. And he was that type of naval officer sort of thing. They wanted Robbie to be realistic. So that's why you don't really see a face on Robbie. You see a mechanical humanoid sort of approach. Some cool trivia. Anne Francis and the tiger never appeared on the same stage. The tiger is totally superimposed into that shot, both shots. So even the shot when she calls...
Don't they use a split screen?
Yeah, when she calls him and he comes in and she almost pets him and he walks away from her and everything else and it's all sweet and nice, they're not in the same shot at all.
Yeah, Tammy and the Bachelor was the following year. He did do one other movie the same time as Forbidden Planet called Ransom.
Mm.
But everything else prior to that was television. Yeah.
Okay. Although a majority of the movie is exterior, or even the huge, vast exteriors of the Krell Laboratory, everything is shot inside on a soundstage. Nothing was shot on location. Thought that was kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Most of it was filmed at the same stages that Wizard of Oz were filmed. I'm just droning on the trivia.
Yeah, that's what I have in trivia as well, about the Munchkin Village. I knew I had it somewhere. The only other trivia that I have, I'll get to later. I'll do that after casting because it should come later anyway.
Okay.
I will say that ship design has appeared in a bazillion things.
Oh, yeah.
Mostly Twilight Zone episodes. They reuse that spaceship for a lot of Twilight Zone episodes, including Third from the Sun, The Monsters on Maple Street, Invaders, To Serve Man, Hocus Pocus and the Frisbee, Death Ship, and On Thursday We Leave Home. The Robbie vehicle appears in the final scene of the Rip Van Winkle Caper, which is a movie I've never heard of, and the outfits were used in a number of episodes of The Time Machine, the 1960 television series.
Wow.
Yeah, and then the flickering force field fence post appeared in Atlantis, The Lost Continent, which was also the 60s, 1961, and the one they were seen at the bottom of the ocean in Around the World Under the Sea. So MGM likes to reuse stuff or at least loan them out to others to use.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think we mentioned it when we did Time Machine. The uniforms, the military uniforms of the crew are used in Time Machine when they go into the future.
That's right. Yeah. I forgot about that. You're absolutely right. I've got some casting notes if you want me to move on to that.
Yeah, we could do cast. Plastic. And then I've got some Robbie stuff, too, and he's part of the cast, so we can round out with that.
Okay, I'll just pull them up on my plastic educator.
Yeah, please do.
This movie stars Walter Pidgeon, mainly because he was the most well-known at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Walter Pidgeon was a silent film actor that goes way back into the 20s, but he's known for things, not science fiction really, but he's known for Mrs. Miniver and Funny Girl, the Barbara Streisand movie, also that was in the 60s. Wasn't it? Funny Girl was late 60s, I think.
Yeah, right? Pretty sure. You're right.
He is an Oscar-nominated actor. He was Oscar-nominated for Madame Curie and Mrs. Miniver. And that's all I have on Mr. Pidgeon. But I think I saw either something we're doing in the future that he's also in. I can't remember, but I guess we'll get to it when we get to it.
You'll see it.
I'm pretty sure I saw that he's going to be in another movie that we're doing coming up. Mm-hmm. I may be just dreaming. Anyway.
No, you're right.
Anne Francis, coincidentally, was also in Funny Girl. She was a big television actress. Numerous credits on TV after this. I don't really have any other on her.
Mm-hmm.
Leslie Nielsen, however, is probably the most famous person to come out of this in retrospect. He got really popular in the late 80s, early 90s doing comedies like Airplane and The Naked Gun. We know him, of course, from Creepshow. He's in the third one, Something to Tide You Over.
Yes.
He's great in that because he's comedic and he's dark. But he also did Day of the Animals, which may even be on our list. I can't remember. That's a real cheesy sci-fi animal, like out-of-control movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then, as I also mentioned, he was in Tammy and the Bachelor, which my mother had the soundtrack for. So I remember that because I used to see him on that album. He has over 260 credits to his name. He was a very prolific actor, I should say.
Very.
As you said, this was his film debut, and we mentioned Star Trek and its relations to this. According to Star Trek story editor and screenwriter D.C. Fontana, Nielsen called the production office the morning after the first episode aired with high praise. So he was a fan of Star Trek early on and saw exactly what they were doing.
Well, I'm sure he did.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of cool. Warren Stevens is another major TV actor. He played Lieutenant Doc Ostro. He was in the Star Trek episode By Any Other Name. He played
Rojan.
Called Rojan.
Yeah.
It's like Trojan without a T.
Yep. Rojan. He's great in that. It's a really good. And he was always good in television as either the boyfriend or the mean boyfriend who was upset kind of thing. He always plays that secondary character kind of thing. He's really good at that.
He's got a very familiar face.
Oh, yeah.
When you see him.
Yeah, Wild Wild West and a bunch of other 60s.
Right. But even seeing him in this movie young, I remember him more as an older TV actor.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah.
The same thing with Richard Anderson. I mean, we always remember Richard Anderson from television.
Oh, absolutely. He's Oscar Goldman.
Yeah.
As soon as you see him, I'm like, oh, $6 million man.
Yep.
Well, since you mentioned it, I'll go ahead and say him. He played Chief Quinn. Mm-hmm. He has 192 credits, mostly television as well. But yes, we know him as Oscar Goldman from The $6 Million Man. Jumping back a little bit, Lieutenant Farman, who I'm thinking that's Jerry, right?
Yeah, Jerry.
He was played by Jack Kelly. He's best remembered as trading quips with James Garner on Maverick. So he was a regular on Maverick.
Okay.
He was the less laid-back brother named Bart Maverick. So that's what we know Jack Kelly from. The cook you mentioned, who is the comic relief in this, is played by another big television actor, Earl Holliman. He's the only surviving cast member of this movie right now. He is still with us. He was born in 1928. He starred in some movies you would remember him from. He was in The Sons of Katie Elder and Giant, which are both sort of like Westerns. Giant's not really, but most people remember him as the guy on Policewoman with Angie Dickinson.
Yep.
I can't remember what his title was on that show. But he plays the cook that basically tricks Robbie into making him a mound of booze, a pile of booze bottles.
Yep.
What is it, bourbon? I can't remember.
Yeah, it's bourbon.
Is it bourbon? Okay. Bosun is played by George D. Wallace. He has 237 credits, including The Towering Inferno and Minority Report.
Mm-hmm.
So that guy was with us for a while as well. And the rest I'm not going to mention because I really don't have any information on them.
The only other one casting-wise I remember is James Drury is in this. And he was a big Western guy. And he's one of the crewmen, too. but
he plays one of the crewmen. Yeah. I do have his name here, but I just didn't have anything that he had done. Awards. This movie, you said, was not nominated for score, but it was nominated, and it did not win the best special effects for 1957. What do you know what won? I should look that up.
Yeah, I do know what won. The Ten Commandments. What? The Ten Commandments beat it. And I'm going, well,
there's
seriously?
Some pretty good effects in that movie.
Well, yeah. I mean, there are. You've got the parting of the Red Sea, and you've got the chariot.
The snake. The staff turning into the snake.
Yeah, but who is this Moses? Should not beat out Forbidden Planet. I mean, come on. It's Forbidden Planet.
I kind of agree with you there. But, you know, they had God on their side. What can I say?
Yeah, true.
It was a winner for the National Film Preservation Award in 2013. So it is on the preservation list.
Mm-hmm.
And it is on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list. This is a list that we talk about a lot. It's from a book by Stephen J. Schneider. He updates it occasionally. So there's more than 1001 movies now. I think the last update was a couple of years back. But anyway, this one is on it. So that's what I have for cast and awards.
My last little cast thing is this movie will always be known. Even if you hated the saucer ship, you didn't like the 50s captain making his woman make the coffee, you know, kind of attitudes, Morbius, any of the other stuff, this movie will always be known for Robbie. It introduced Robbie the robot, like just like the ship. Robbie went on to appear in everything. I mean, he was in Lost in Space, Columbo, Twilight Zone. Robbie was everywhere. I think he's even in a Mork and Mindy, and I know he's in a Big Bang Theory. As Robbie, not as just the prop, as Robbie, the robot sort of thing.
Well, I was going to say, he looks very similar to the robot in Lost in Space. So did they become friends or something?
Curious you should say that. He appears and actually has a little bit of a battle with the Lost in Space robot
I'm sure I saw it.
Interesting that we need to recognize, and hopefully I'll pronounce it correctly, Robert Kinoshita. Robert Kinoshita designed Robbie the robot. He also designed the robot from Lost in Space. So it's kind of a key. Okay. Do you want to hazard to guess what he was prior to designing robots for movies?
The name sounds Native American.
He was Japanese. He was a Japanese-American engineer who designed washing machines. That's what he did before coming to Hollywood and designing Robbie the robot.
That would be funny if he'd have put like one of those little round open doors on his chest plate or something.
Yeah. The name
front loading washer we have here.
The name Robbie was actually used in an Isaac Asimov short story, and it was about a robot, Robbie the robot. He obeys.
Which came first?
Robbie came before the short story. But he obeys the three laws of robotics, which came before Robbie. So the three laws being a robot cannot harm a human being. Law number two is a robot must always obey a human being unless it conflicts with the first law. And law three is a robot must not allow himself to be harmed unless it conflicts with the second or first law. So Robbie does that. And I love the way Morbius shows that by saying, okay, now shoot the commander. And it's a very Star Trek scene. It's a very great scene. I say it's Star Trek scene, even though this was predate Star Trek. But you know, that whole, because the other two guys react and pull their guns and the commander doesn't even flinch. He kind of flinches a little and just kind of goes, sure, go ahead and shoot me then, kind of thing. And he doesn't, trusting him. It's really cool. Like I said, designed the robot for Lost in Space as well. Robbie ended up costing 7% of the entire budget of the film, which makes it the most expensive prop in movie history at the time. Since then, there have been other props that have cost more, but he was hugely expensive. His value has never been underrated. He actually, in November of 2017, a restored Robbie the robot sold at auction for $5.3 million, becoming the most expensive movie prop ever sold at an auction. So that's kind of his legacy. And like I said, he has inspired robots from that sardonic voice to the temperament. He has such key influences to robots ever since then, sort of thing.
Where would you put him if you had him? like in the foyer.
Yes. Yeah. So the first thing you see, and I would also, you know, have him go ahead and pre-recorded say, "Welcome, gentlemen.
Welcome to Altair 4, gentlemen."
When people walk in, it would be great. Funny. I say that because I think Robbie is a good example of the realism that they treated this script, the fact that they, the things they used, even like Bellerophon. Bellerophon was a Greek warrior. So the names, Altair, instead of saying Mercury or a name that we know, they made it a star and a component of a star. It's Altair 4. And
which is very Star Trek.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, once once we get, you know, when we're ready to jump to Keys, there's a plethora of Star Trek references. I do, but I like the fact that they treated the entire situation, the thematic, the story very realistically. They didn't stop and explain stuff. So they didn't, you know, this is a blaster, Altera. This is how the blaster works. They didn't do any of that. It's a gun. They would use a gun. That they use it just like they do. It's a very Gene Roddenberry mentality. I like the suspense and the pacing of this. I mean, from the very beginning and we first see the ship, but then it's not just we're on the planet. We get the whole eclipse section and the whole deceleration part and the whole, there's a lot of the shipbound stuff, a lot more so than you kind of remember when you watch it again, to set everything up before we even land on the planet and meet Robbie and Altair. And, I think the only
next. It's not really in medias res because it does have a beginning with them on the ship and then landing. But it's like an in, I don't know what the word is. It's just when they just basically throw you in and don't explain everything to you. They just take for granted that you're going to know
what
it, this is. And that's great because it's a lot less exposition.
Yes. And I like when exposition is done that way rather than a POV character, hero, or heroine, and we have to explain everything to them. A la mate.
Yeah, these guns were developed in the year blah, blah, blah.
You know, they say, get to the deceleration tubes, and then we go and we have this cool sequence with special effects and everything, and they seem kind of groggy when they're done, but we don't explain any of that. And we don't go into what that does or why we have to do that or blah, 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 whatever. It's just accepted. We do it. We go on, which is cool. And I like that approach to the storytelling. I think in my notes, the only negative, positive is also the way they do these scenes and moods works. I mean, the monster is scary. And when he's invading the ship, that's a creepy sequence. And you see things move and there's nobody there moving them. And it's an invisible monster. And we're going, oh, my gosh. And, you know, there's genuine suspense at the end when it's coming to burn through the door and kill them all sort of thing. There's remorse and regret with Morbius and all that. I think the only negative I've got in it is it still has that 50s mentality, especially the misogynistic side of it, you know, the wolf whistle and the treat, you know, hitting on Altera the way they all are. And
it's very a victim of its time in history,
of course,
as far as like, you know, the women are going to get hit on, they're going to be pretty, they're going to be in short skirts, what have you.
Yes,
go get me some coffee,
yeah. That kind of thing, housewife's dream kind of stuff. Yeah, it is what it is.
Not flying away.
No,
unless it was a satire.
Right. What else? Any of my notes?
I may have another trivia before we jump to Keys. This is what I was going to explain earlier. There have been several remakes attempted with this movie, and none have ever come to fruition. The early was a 90s remake that was announced several times with Irvin Kershner, who did Star Wars V, The Empire Strikes Back, with Anthony Hopkins as Morbius. But the financing kept falling through. I think Anthony Hopkins would have made a great Morbius.
Oh, gosh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, in a heartbeat. And then in 2008, Warner Brothers announced a remake with Joel Silver to produce, and your buddy, J. Michael Straczynski, penning the screenplay.
Yep.
At various stages prior to that, Davis Twoge, Sterling Siliphant, and even James Cameron were attached as writers to proposed remakes of this film.
God, Cameron would so screw this up. Anyway.
Maybe. I don't know. He can do military pretty well.
Yeah. And it is a military-type crew like Star Trek.
Yeah.
But anyway, the one thing that struck me because of my obvious love of horror movies is that networks would often air Forbidden Planet as a Halloween special in the 1970s.
Oh, wow.
And this is... Yeah, and this is referenced in John Carpenter's classic Halloween, because the film is playing on television in one of the scenes in that movie.
Yep.
So basically, and then of course, John Carpenter went on to do The Thing, which is just, you know, he's obviously a fan of 50s sci-fi. So,
yeah, the two in Halloween, the two keys in Halloween are that and The Thing, right? That's what they're watching at two different times.
Yeah, there may even be another one.
Yeah.
But yeah, those two for sure are in Halloween.
Interesting.
Because it's like Lindsay and the little boy are watching a horror sci-fi marathon on television while Michael Myers is killing everybody else.
Yep.
Basically. Yeah. So that's what I have. We can move on to keys unless you want to.
No, keys are fine. Anything. Yeah. And there's a ton. I've got a ton of keys, of course.
I do. I have a pretty good bit too. So we'll probably overlap.
I've got, my first one is, so a long extinct race whose technology is left over. This is definitely a Star Trek trope that appears a lot, especially like in Doomsday Machine and that sort of thing, but also Stargate and also Babylon 5. So, because Babylon 5 has a great machine, which is this huge, inside the planet's core, powered by the planet sort of machine that is where the Babylon station is in orbit around. So, I've got that one. I've got, I already had this one before, but many of the costumes were repurposed. Of course, the uniforms were in Time Machine. Altera's dresses were used in Queen of Outer Space with Zsa Zsa Gabor.
And I've never, Zsa Zsa Gabor. I know that movie.
I've never seen that movie. I've heard of it, but I've never watched it. So
I've never seen it, but I know of it because it's notoriously bad from what I hear. So
yeah, evidently they use Altera's dresses, miniskirts for that.
How funny.
Yeah.
We mentioned Star Trek and Lost in Space, and you're going to get to several Star Treks. Mm-hmm. But I would also mention Sigmund Freud is obviously a key to this because they talk about the id, the ego, and the superego, and this is a monster from the id, which is your darker part of your subconscious.
But the Krell forgot one thing.
Yes, what?
Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
But Morbius, the name, I know from, and Jared Leto did a, from what I understand, a not-so-great movie a couple of years back, but I loved the comic book, and he was a vampire named Morbius.
And he's essentially playing Prospero, who is the wizard in Tempest, except his wizardry in this is technology, of course. Yeah, so that's a Marvel character, Morbius is?
Morbius is. And like I said, Jared Leto did a movie of it a couple of years back, and it does not get high praise, so I don't know if they messed it up or what.
No, it pretty much
Morbius bombed. Used to team up with Spider-Man sometimes when I was reading comic books, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And I've got, what else? I had some thought. I wanted to talk to you about that one, about Morbius. But maybe it was before Morbius. What did you say before that?
You mentioned Sigmund Freud.
Oh, yeah. I didn't do the research. I don't know when that came about. When was Freud's first big expose or essay on the three and the division of the mind in that way?
You know, I didn't do the research on that either. I can give it a quick look.
I'm wondering how timely it was to when this movie was. Maybe they were talking about it at the time in the mid-50s or whatever. Anyway, we had mentioned the influence of some of the props and the costumes and the ship itself being used. The Jupiter 2, they have said, was definitely influenced by Forbidden Planet, and their robot, of course, was influenced and designed by the same designer. As well, the tubes that they decelerate in are the same tubes. They repurpose them for the Jupiter 2. And the astrogator, the very center thing that they use to navigate the spaceship.
The big ball, the crystal, I guess you'd say, like crystal ball.
That is in the very center of the Jupiter 2. So the same thing.
Oh, how funny.
Also, the force fields, which the Jupiter 2 ended up, you know, put a tower out with some blinking lights on the side and you've got a force field. That was the same concept that they repurposed in Lost in Space from this. So there you go.
Nice.
Well,
I have Rocky Horror.
Oh, yep. Of course. The opening song. Because,
yeah.
And Francis stars in Forbidden Planet.
And then for some reason, I put Doctor Who, and I can't remember why.
But I'm not certain.
I mean, it's got a robot. There's robots in Doctor Who.
Well, there are the Daleks.
It seems like there's something.
The Daleks.
The Daleks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
That's probably it. Speaking of robots, I've got, of course, Robbie's voice influenced robots for generations to come, including HAL in 2001.
Including probably C-3PO in Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. I've got one that you might like considering the Disney connection, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, because Morbius is a lot like Nemo. They're avoiding civilization. They've got all this technology that they think humanity can't handle.
Super smart.
They can only do it themselves. It's this genius sort of philosophy, you know, sort of thing. So, had that. Yeah. I have Metropolis. And not just because there's a robot in Metropolis, which there is, but the whole Metropolis was so grand in showing everything, you know, the cities were these vast, huge places, which is just like the Krell. Their laboratories and the Krell, you know, the Krell technology is these huge, fast things, which they filmed by doing. That was another thing I had in trivia that I forgot. There were no new techniques developed for this. You know, we talk about when Star Wars came out, they had to develop the motion control camera. For certain Disney things, they developed the multi-plane projector thing to do this. No new technologies were used in this at all. It's just the way they used them. Like, they would put the camera at the very, very top in the back of the studio and film people all the way in the opening doors way over here for the matte shots of the Krell Laboratory. So that they were just like this big in the frame, this huge cinemascope frame. And they would get them.
That's hilarious.
They would have to have like three people yell at them to do the actions just so they could film them. And then they just matted them into these matte paintings, which everyone was doing at the time. Even Charlie Chaplin had matte paintings. So that was a big deal. But no new technologies were developed. What else you got?
Well, this one I remembered. I did not write it down. But I am fairly certain in our first season when we covered Planet of the Apes that the claw they find that is a remnant of this monster of the id is on display in the museum with humans in Planet of the Apes.
Yes, it is.
It can be seen in one shot.
Yes, it is. That's an awesome key. So, yeah, that is totally true.
I just remembered it. I didn't have it written down. I was like, why don't I have that note in here? But anyway, it's in my head.
I have War of the Worlds because the opening font and the opening credits, the way they're done with like this kind of folded font graphic that looks kind of weird and like a three-quarter angle, that's exactly the same as in War of the Worlds.
Yeah, and in the trailer for the movie, they do a crawl very similar to Star Wars.
Very true. I have that in my Star Wars keys, but yes. I have one you may...
You have sub-keys. Subsections.
Subsections of keys. I have one you may like, Tommyknockers. Stephen King.
Yeah, I have that one.
Which is what? You're Stephen King. You should know that.
Yeah. Well, in Tommyknockers, there's a place where David Brown is like this aspiring musician. He's this kid, and he makes his brother disappear, and his brother ends up on Altair 4.
Yep.
Planet Altair 4 under alien influences. Yeah, he makes him disappear in a backyard magic show, basically.
Yep.
But Tommyknockers is not a great book, but I remember that.
I had, you had mentioned Marvel, and I was interested because when they started talking about Krell technology and Robbie and everything else, Robbie is made out of adamantium. And I thought, isn't that what Wolverine's
X-Men
claws are? X-Men, whatever?
Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure.
So I went into a rabbit hole about that. Adamantium, it was actually first mentioned in the Enid, I think is the way you pronounce it, A-E-N-E-I-D,
The Aeneid.
Aeneid.
You're talking about Virgil.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Adamantium as a mineral is actually first mentioned there. It's also in Paradise Lost. It's in Gulliver's Travels. It's in The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. It's in The Lord of the Rings. Then in Forbidden Planet.
Really?
And all of those predate Marvel. I thought that
was very interesting. I'm going to put the Aeneid as the original key, if that's where it originated.
Supposedly that was the original.
That's as old as like...
Oh, yeah. Literature.
It's the Italian version of Odysseus,
yes.
Basically. The Aeneid is.
Okay.
So that's old.
That's old.
Ancient Rome.
That's some ancient. That's some old there.
It'd be old.
I
did not know that. I have a copy of the Aeneid, a really nice one, actually. I was going to say Alien, and this is a stretch, but the reason I'm saying Alien is because of those ancient astronauts left behind on whatever the name of that planet is,
yep,
that they land on,
mm-hmm,
and you actually see the mummified corpse of one in a pilot seat,
yep,
or whatever, and they're giant,
mm-hmm,
you know, which I would think the Krell would be pretty big too.
Yes.
So it's a bit of a stretch, but you know, no more than whatever those Marvel villains are.
I agree with that. No, I think that's great. I've got Robbie's car, or not Robbie's, but the shuttle car that they use. Reminds me, and I think there's a version of it, but it reminds me of like a James Bond villain car. I don't know if it's in Moonraker or if it might be in Thunderball when they're actually at the guy's lair, which is below the telescope. You know what I mean? But that kind of...
I don't know what one it is, but I know what you mean. They always had all kinds of gadgets on there.
Well, this kind of...
And vehicles.
Weird vehicle kind of thing. And also the tube transport, you know, when they get in, when he's showing off the Krell and they get in the tube transport and they're in the big tunnel kind of thing. That's really similar to Gene Roddenberry's Planet Earth and Earth 2, The Incredibles.
And Logan's
Run. Yeah. And even down to, like, I just saw it, this past winter, the Polar Express. They get into those little tube cars and go to get to Santa.
Yeah, I just remember it because we did Logan's Run recently.
Yeah.
We do it in that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Same thing.
That's funny.
So lots of keys in that form of transportation. And this being, as far as I know, the first time we see that kind of tube subway faster than anything transportation.
Well, the vehicle itself reminded me of a land speeder from Star Wars.
Oh, yeah. The way it kind of floated and anti-gravved and
yeah,
all that.
Yeah, it just zips around, you know, and they ride in it. But it's like a car. Yeah.
Well, and I have that. So I have that subcategory I have is Star Wars of the 50s, which is what this is, which is the hovering of the tube. Hologram. We get to see the little hologram of Altera, which is just like Princess Leia. This,
right.
The Death Star in several references, just in the fact that you have all these huge, massive 70-story platforms with no rails. Anyway, they're crossing these great big chasms. There's no rails anywhere, which is very Death Star, you know. Robbie is...
Oh, yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, for sure.
Robbie is like R2-D2 and C-3PO put together. You know what I mean? He can do anything, but he has a personality.
He has a voice.
Yeah. But he's like R2. He can make a dress out of emeralds, or he can boil your coffee, or he can hold up lead with one arm.
He
you know,
can give
sort
you
of thing.
200 bottles of bourbon or whatever.
Yeah. And make it overnight. You know, sort
of thing. That was crazy. I stumbled upon that pile of bourbon. I was like, what?
And for me, one of the keys of the Star Wars of the 50s section is, it's kind of like Lucas did the same thing. I'm going to throw you into this universe and we're just going to accept everything. And we go with it, that there are giant, huge lunars, you know, star, planet-sized spaceships. But everything else is lived in. And we've got these little droids that look like toasters that we don't even know what they do, but they're going to be there. And they go throughout our world kind of thing. So that whole design element and storytelling element of, we're not going to stop and explain everything, we're just going to go. Which I really liked about this. I think that's all my big keys except for my Star Trek keys, which I've got like 12 of those.
Well, I had the Tempest, which we've already mentioned.
Yep.
The Green Sky paid homage to the 1933 novel When Worlds Collide by Philip Wiley and Edwin Balmer.
Yeah.
In it, the sky on the primary alien planet was green. A species of green algae there used sunlight to separate the water into hydrogen and oxygen and stored the hydrogen in sacks, allowing it to float in the air.
That's now, a good one.
I will admit, I lifted that one from IMDb because I don't know anything about that.
That's a good one. I'd forgotten that.
Yeah. And then you also mentioned Isaac Asimov's Three Laws of mm-hmm. Robotics. Three Laws mm-hmm. of Robotics. That's in there.
Oh, I have a personal one. You know when
sure.
it's kind of a comic beat, but Robbie is in the room and in the foreground we see the monkey kind of sneak in from outside and he goes over and grabs some fruit and Robbie kind of pops him with a blast of energy and shoots him across the room and the monkey leaves. It reminds me of the monkey in Raiders of the Lost Ark, the capuchin that's always crawling around on her shoulder and then he's eating the figs and then he's always into everything. he does the little Heil Hitler thing. I was going, that capuchin monkey reminds me of this one.
Yeah, it may be. Well, it wouldn't be the same, but they're yeah, but similar.
Yeah. I mean, just as a comic relief bit. Not like that right. one, that movie where he's handy.
Monkey Shines.
Yeah. Ooh. I don't.
Now you're in my territory.
Yeah. That's a bad.
And then
monkey.
the only other key I have, you've also mentioned, and it was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. So if you want to go off on your Star Wars, Star Trek, you go for it.
Star Trek. I mean, nobody can watch Forbidden Planet and not see Star Trek. I don't think anybody, especially original series Star Trek, not so much Next Generation, but yeah, Next Generation as well, Deep Space Nine as well, all the iterations. I don't think, I agree with your point. There would not be a Star Trek unless there had been Forbidden Planet. I think Roddenberry.
And it's only 10 years prior.
Yeah. I think Roddenberry, Kuhn, Matt Jeffries, I think everybody was influenced by this movie to create their vision of Star Trek when it came up. Mm-hmm. So you've got a military crew that are basically explorers, although they still operate under military rule and doctrine and all of that. You've got the crew of Star Trek acts the same. They interact the same. They have the same hierarchy of command. And there's like a triad there. We have the XO, the Doctor, and the commander, which would be the science officer, the captain, and the doctor from Star Trek. Transporters were inspired by these kind of deceleration tubes or these deceleration things they have to get in sort of thing. People have said, and you'll find a lot of reviews as you look for Forbidden Planet on YouTube and other places, that people have said that, I think even one of the documentaries, Leslie Nielsen says it, but Forbidden Planet is the pilot for Star Trek. And if you watch The Cage, it surely is. I mean, it reminds you a lot of it, you know, an ancient race and all that kind of stuff. Let's see, the plot that they're to, the original, that's another Star Trek trope. The reason they are there is to search for survivors of the Bellerophon, which is The Cage. That's the same storyline. And everything. Warren Stevens, you already mentioned, is the doctor, but he's also Rojan in By Any Other Name, which is a Kelvin, which is an alien that we also never see. So it's another strange alien that we never see. Roddenberry has even, or Matt Jeffries has stated that the Enterprise designation is 1701. And when they are landing on the planet, if you look in the background on the panel behind them, the readout reads 1701. And that's where they got those initials from. It's to pay homage. That was directly to pay homage to Forbidden Planet. So that's a direct key that has been quoted and said before. The C-57D has 1701 on its panel. Of course, Nielsen's character, Adams, is so similar to Kirk. You know, he's the strong guy, but he's also got the intelligence, but he can yell at his crew, but then say, you know, my most important thing is my ship and the safety of my crew and all of that kind of attitude. And, you know, of course, he gets the girl at the end. In fact, that's another plot point that I think is a little cheated and thrown together. I mean, you've got Jerry hitting on her. He interrupts him. And then suddenly he tells Jerry not to go on the next landing party or away mission, you know, whatever. And he says, oh, so I guess I see rank has its privilege. He goes, no, it's not it at all, you dick, you know, whatever. But then later on, he says, I'm going to take Altera with us. And he goes, yeah, the right man won, sir. And I'm like, what was that?
It's weird. It reminded me of how Captain Kirk always gets the girl, but like Chekhov's always hitting on him.
Yeah.
And you're like, Chekhov, get out of here. You know who's going to get her.
Or Scotty. Scotty's always hitting on him too.
Yeah. Right.
That's true. And as a matter of fact, Altera is a lot like, not just the miniskirt, but she's a lot like Star Trek women. You know, very influenced by the power, very enamored with the captain, thinks he's wonderful, has some witty retorts, but she's mostly, oh, I'm falling in love with him, you know, kind of thing.
That woman in the cage, wasn't she the same actress that played Luann on Gomer Pyle? If not, they're very similar.
No,
or maybe
no,
Andy Griffith.
No, I don't think so. I don't think
anyway,
she
they
was.
All look like Anne Francis does in this movie.
Yes.
That like blonde, cute, miniskirt, that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yep. Both stories take place in the 23rd century. Doors swish and open automatically, which they do in this. They have a tricorder. It has a little microphone that goes with a camera that he moves around, but it's a tricorder. Essentially, it's scanning the area. I thought the main batteries reminded me of in the cage when they bring the main phaser bank down to fire. It's that kind of thing. We have to dismantle it from the ship, take it out, rebuild it, and then we can shoot at something kind of thing.
Yeah, that was funny.
Of course, just like all the best Star Treks, you send all the key crew personnel down to the planet and you send them to the alien race as the very first thing. And that's all I've got. So, and I think the overall ethos of this feels, this could easily be a Star Trek episode, you know, totally.
It's to go where no man has gone before.
Yep.
Except somebody had actually gone there before and they were going there to rescue
them. That was it. Yeah. And they were just coming back. But I, you know, I've droned on and on and on just because I love this movie. This is probably in my top five movies of all time. I could watch this movie over and over. It is science fiction. You know, I've always said that Andromeda is my definition of a science fiction film, but this is really close to, as far as a space science fiction film, this would be my first, probably.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nice. And you said you had Star Wars ones too, didn't you? Or am I?
I gave the Star Wars one with the hologram.
That's right. You did. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess that's going to sum it up. I think that you can tell by our enthusiasm how much we both like this movie. Mm-hmm. Forbidden Planet from, was it 1956, I believe?
Correct.
And we hope you enjoyed this little redux we did, bringing you one out of the vault from season one.
Woo-hoo!
We've got a lot of good things. We're in the, I guess you'd say, the downhill of season six, but we've got a lot of good things coming up. We're doing a regular horror movie next week. Then we've got two double features in a row. And I guess that's it.
Well, Patreon, subscribe, like, give us stars, go to Apple, give us good reviews, all that stuff.
Yeah, I mentioned beforehand, if you want to know what movies we're going to do on Mondays, you either have to join our Facebook page where we do promos on Thursdays, or YouTube. We do promos on Thursdays on YouTube as well. Or you can sign up for our mailing list because I do send out an email every Friday announcing what Monday's movie will be. Or you can go to Patreon. As David said, there are several things and several reasons to become a patron of Johnny Has the Keys. The smallest of which is that you'll get the list of the entire season's worth of movies in advance. But we also have bonus episodes out the wazoo over there. And if you pay a little bit more, we have two other shows over there. One specifically on Star Trek, the original series, and one specifically on the X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess until next time when I'll be seeing you back in the shadowed corridors of horror.
I'll be scary. Seeing you, Dave. All right, man. Have a good one.
All right. You too. Bye.
Bye.